Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Que quiere marcharse de Semedo. Semedo de momento está enchufado. Ahora justo lo digo y justo se pierde. Ay, a punto ha estado de cometer penalti. Gol de Nicolás Pepe. Pepe. Nicolás.
Is Arsecast Extra.
Hello and welcome to another Arsecast Extra, as always, with James from Gunnerblog. James, good morning to you. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well, Andrew. How are you?
I'm all right. I hear your mower guy there in the background. He's doing the thing with his...
He won't die, Andrew. He just won't die, that guy. Every Sunday night, I say my prayers and hope he will pass on. And then every Monday morning, he's back. What can I do?
Seems like an extreme solution to hope for his demise
I'm going to have to take matters into my own hand, Andrew. He leaves me no choice other than to commit an act of murder.
Fair enough. Look, if you're looking for an alibi, you don't have one now because it's here in audio format.
Oh, shit.
You know, if something happens to that guy now, you're suspect number one.
I will be getting a knock on my door, sure. Whenever it eventually happens.
whenever you break and snap and just, you know, take matters into your own hands, of course. Beyond that, how is everything? Are you excited as an England fan now that the potential of it coming home appears to be greater? And by it, I mean football and not Bukayo Saka on an inflatable rainbow unicorn, which is perhaps one of the greatest images I've ever seen in my life.
I'm just trying to think if murdering a gardener would contravene my CBBC contract. I'll have to check the small print on that later. But as for it coming home atop said inflatable unicorn, I am excited. I can't lie to you, Andrew. I mean, the nation has been, as is often the case in tournaments, swept up. I think our semi-final exit against Denmark is going to be some way to puncture the inflatable mythical creature. But yes, I am excited. And as for that image of Saka, I mean, absolutely extraordinary in this sort of era of meme culture.
Yeah.
It was almost like it had been deliberately concocted to set the internet aflame.
Well, I mean, they even put out a blank Saka image that people could use for their own photoshops and things like that. So even though
England
on the actual @England account, after posting the pictures, they put, here's a blank one. Do your worst or do your best or whatever it is with the photoshops and stuff like that. So even people with minimal Photoshop experience could have at it and make the images, et cetera, that were flying around. But it's very wholesome, isn't it? Bukayo Saka on an inflatable rainbow unicorn.
And it's, do you know what? It's quite reassuring as well, because technically he missed the last England game with an injury problem. I think from that picture, from the photo evidence we have, we can assume it's not too serious. he seems to be absolutely fine. And yeah, it's just a great, great picture. I mean, you know, I think Jonathan Liu wrote a piece in The Guardian after Saka's first appearance in the tournament saying, welcome to the summer of Saka, was kind of the thrust of it.
Right.
And that, you know, if this does transpire to be the summer of Saka, I think that will be the image that sort of encapsulates it.
If England do win it, I want to see Bukayo Saka paraded through the streets of Islington, held high while sitting on that unicorn.
As do I. As do
with
I.
The trophy around his neck and everything else.
Leap from the roof of Islington Town Hall with only the inflatable unicorn to protect him. No, I was at the England-Germany game, which feels ever so long ago.
Doesn't it? Yeah.
And I've got to say, that was quite a...
You looked like you had a good time, in fairness. I saw some of the pictures. You looked like you were enjoying yourself.
I had a really good time, and it was the best stadium experience I've had for a really long time, as you're probably no doubt aware. It felt, I think it was half capacity, but it felt absolutely rocking. I mean, the atmosphere was quite incredible, and to be part of that after such a long time was fantastic. I can't lie. I do like an international tournament. I do tend to get behind England when they come around. And things look really promising for them. I mean, they've been very fortunate the way the draw has panned out. You know, Ukraine weren't much of a test for them in the quarterfinal. Absolute steamroller them, really. I mean, they didn't really turn up. And now Denmark. And to be fair, Denmark look very good. They have recovered incredibly from that initial setback with the Christian Eriksen trauma. Yeah. And they've got some really good players. I think they're ranked top 10 in the world. I think that'll be a good game.
Yeah, I think so too. And I guess for everybody beyond the teams that are involved, Denmark would be, I suppose, the neutrals' favourite.
I think
you
so.
Know? Not just because of what happened with Christian Eriksen, but obviously I think that has, you know, the story it has... that has developed out of that is really something quite remarkable. It feels like a sort of six-part Netflix documentary at some point in the future, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I think they'll kind of be the heroes of the tournament, almost whatever happens at this stage. I mean, it's been such an incredible story. I feel for their fans. I think it's not really possible for them to come to Wembley from Denmark for this game, I seem to read somewhere. I'm sure some will find a way, as seems to be happening across Europe. You know, a few international supporters are, I don't know, sneaking in via other countries and what have you. But that's another big thing in England's favour, of course. I mean, if they do get to the final, they'll have played 7 of their 8 games at Wembley Stadium. It's a massive advantage.
Home advantage. And look, there are probably still some Danish people left in the UK, so there might be some of those around for that game. But I am looking forward to that one. And Italy versus...
And the other semi looks tasty too.
Yeah, Italy versus Spain as well. So, I mean, what did you make of the Italy-Belgium game? I had a question here. Might as well do some questions while we're doing this. It comes from Piers Bate, who says, goodly morning. I was reading this morning about Italy only allowing the ball to be in play for 9 of the final 21 minutes against Belgium. Do you think this should be celebrated as controlling the game or just part of the game? Or, he said, do you think we could move to a system similar to basketball or rugby with more accurate in-game clock? I suppose the other aspect of this is there was some criticism of Italy for their... I mean, some people would call it cheating. Other people would call it gamesmanship. I thought it was really quite funny that there was so much focus on this. Like, it's the first time it's ever happened. And everyone's like, oh, my goodness, they've really brought the game into disrepute here. We would never do anything like that. It's scandalous. How could they? It was bizarre, wasn't it?
Yeah, I was going to ask what you made of it, actually, because I know, you know, you are, what's the word? You don't mind a bit of shithousing at times.
Well, once we're doing it, I very much object to it when it's being done to us. But as, you know, I feel like there is a need for cynicism within the game of football. And you know, you have to be able to make it as difficult as possible for the opposition in any way you can. You know, if it means bending the rules a little bit, then, you know, so be it. People talk about Man City being a great footballing team, right? A really talented team with lots of great players, but, you know, their rotational fouling, et cetera, is part of what they did. Same with Barcelona. You know, they at their best were an amazing football team, but they were also like kind of snide. And those two things go, not say they have to go hand in hand, but quite often they do.
No, I mean, you know, it's a slightly different case, but look at even the Invincibles and their disciplinary record. I mean, it was pretty checkered. I think that's the thing about this Italy side. If that's all they had, I would understand the degree of focus on it.
Mm.
But they're actually playing some really good stuff, and they scored two sensational goals in that game.
Yeah.
Really fantastic goals. I mean, obviously, Insigne's was, like, you know, brilliant strike, edge of the box, but I think I preferred the first one. I've forgotten who actually scored it now.
Berardi, was it?
Yeah, I think so. Just the speed of footwork, you know, inside the penalty box to create the space and lash it into the far corner. And I think, you know, Mancini's obviously done a really interesting job with that Italy squad, because I don't think this is the archetypal Italy side that only defends.
Mm.
I think that, that going forward, they play some really nice stuff. Obviously, when they've got a lead to protect, they can kind of lean into Chiellini and, you know, that experience that they have. But I think there is more to them than that. I actually think, overall, I think they're the best team I've seen in this tournament. And I think, you know, were it not for the Wembley factor, I think I'd probably have them as favourites.
It was Barella, actually, who scored that goal. Yeah. And, you know, I quite enjoyed... Look, I thought the Italian goals were very good, but I also thought the Belgian defending was pretty terrible. Like, the second one, was it Alderweireld who just stood off and let him get the shot in? I mean, take nothing away from the finish. And I I know there was all the focus on the player who was down injured, you know... As like, this was simply unacceptable behavior. But, like, if you're a defender of the experience of Thomas Vermaelen, play the ball, play the whistle, you know, don't lose focus and start giving out about a guy who's down on the ground, who was just trying to get a penalty, I guess, which is what players do all the time. And then all of a sudden, 2 seconds later, you're being whizzed by and a bloke is firing the ball into the net, you know?
Yeah, I mean, is it fair to question the selection of Thomas Vermaelen? I mean, I don't know a lot about the other Belgian options. I know they've got Dedryck Boyata, who I think is with Hertha Berlin now. But Vermaelen's been in Japan for 2 years, I think, and he wasn't on top of his game prior to that. You know, I was a little bit surprised to see him come back into the starting 11.
Vermaelen peaked on his Arsenal debut.
Yeah, pretty much. Smashing one in from 25 yards or whatever it was. And... It's weird to think, actually, isn't it, what a Rolls-Royce of a player he did look at first when he came to that team, and never quite delivered against that. A lot of injury problems, of course. But, yeah, I was a little bit surprised to see him start in those games. I don't know what else Belgium have got at the back. But, yeah, in terms of Vermaelen, Vertonghen, Alderweireld, they all feel like they're towards the end of their cycle, as it were. And maybe we're sort of in that place for this golden generation. That was a lot of the talk when Belgium went out. You know, this might be the end of their... that golden era.
It felt very Roberto Martinez, didn't it? The performance.
Yeah. What do you make of Roberto Martinez? Because I find him fascinating. There was a BBC aired a documentary all about his time in Belgium. It's really interesting, really worth watching.
It
sort of goes right from his appointment all through him becoming kind of the manager, then the head of the technical director of the federation, effectively. And he's clearly very well respected, very well thought of, but always seems to be a bit of a kind of nearly man with the results, you know.
Yeah,
I think he'll get a big job actually at some point, a big club job.
Now, when you say a big club job, do you mean like Newcastle, or do you mean a?
No. I mean like a really big, like a sort of, you know. A Champions League, or certainly a top six European club. I do think that. Well, I don't know if that's a good thing or not, but I just think he seems to hold enough sway and respect within the game that I've got a sort of a hunch. I've got a weird hunch that one day he'll be Arsenal manager.
Oh.
Because his strengths and his flaws seem to fit really well.
Yeah, but maybe that would preclude him from taking the job, because we need to, you know, be a bit more strengthy and a lot less flawy, if you know what I mean. But
yeah, but I don't know if you've seen Arsenal and the way we operate.
I have. I listened to him on I think he did the Jamie Carragher podcast a while back.
Right.
Or somebody podcast. Anyway, I listened to him and he sounds like a very nice man, a very intelligent man. He thinks a lot about the game, but it's hard to escape the track record, isn't it? You know?
I think in some ways there are some echoes with Mikel Arteta, in that he's a coach that players kind of eulogise about, speak very highly of, love working with. And it seems to be very well thought of within the game, but maybe the results aren't quite there. Obviously, they're different. But an interesting point is that they do know each other quite well, and apparently that relationship has played a part in Arsenal's interest and pursuit of Albert Zambi-Lokonga. So, you know, Martinez apparently has encouraged quite a lot of young Belgian players to, if possible, move to major European leagues, especially the Premier League. He's a big proponent of the Premier League. And he obviously has seen Lokonga at close hand. He was training with the squad shortly before the Euros. And apparently Arsenal kind of sought his advice on the player. So that'll be an interesting one to watch. And we'll be, I guess, seeing him in part of the Belgian setup going forward, assuming we get that deal done.
Yeah, assuming. Well, look, nothing has happened yet, really, in terms of deals being done. But I note that you guys haven't had a chance to read it yet this morning, but The Athletic have done a piece on Nuno Tavares. So, I mean, that must be based on some relative... what's the word I'm looking for here? Like, you guys, you must think it's certainty. Pretty certainty. Exactly, that's it. So, you know.
We're very, very confident that one will get done. And, you know, that's been reported elsewhere as well. But I think, you know, the players, I think there's even been video footage of him boarding his flight out of Portugal to the UK. So I think that one is a matter of time at this point. And in fact, time was kind of the crucial component in the deal, as far as I can see. Benfica, you know, had interest in the player from other clubs. I think Napoli, I think Southampton looked at him. But ultimately, they had some financial pressures that meant they needed to sell this player pretty quickly in terms of their accounting.
Right.
And Arsenal were able to step in and secure, you know, a fairly reasonable price. I think it's sort of 8 million euros rising to about 10, potentially. You don't get a lot for that these days. To get a player who, you know, feels a need within the squad is a good thing. And as a player, I mean, I think he's pretty raw and I think there's a lot of unknowns, but it's kind of a difficult spot to fill, isn't it?
Yeah.
Do you want to come in and wait for Kieran Tierney to get injured? It's a tricky one. And I think the club have probably made the right decision gambling on a younger guy in that spot who is almost certainly going to improve over the next few years.
Yeah, I mean, there were two ways they could do it. They could bring in a young player who could develop, while Tierney is very much the first choice, or you bring in an old guy who's happy to see out his career and play as and when required. And we've had too many of those old guys, I think. So if this deal does go through, maybe it does suggest that there is a change in the thinking. I think we've highlighted before, haven't we, that when you look at the players that we have been linked with most strongly in this transfer window, they're all sort of in the 20 to 24 age bracket, which suggests a kind of a strategy or at least some kind of joined up thinking there.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, almost exclusively, it's hard to think of anyone who's been seriously linked who's kind of above 24 or something like that. And it does feel deliberate. It does feel like a reaction in some ways to some of what we've seen in the recruitment in the last few years. A lot of short-termism, a lot of stopgap signings. Yeah. Clearly, somebody somewhere along the line appears to have put their foot down about that, or at least made a strategic decision to move away from it. I think it's the kind of signing that fans seem to really want. You know, it's odd. Like, he might be not that good. Like, we don't really know. But it feels economically like a kind of viable gamble.
Yeah, exactly. I think everyone can accept that a transfer works out or doesn't work out. But if you're questioning the intelligence behind a deal, it becomes more difficult, doesn't it? Like, do you want to give a long contract to another 32-year-old? No, you don't. You can't keep doing that. So you need to see some signs that lessons are being learned. And how many times have we spoken about that? So regardless of whether this guy turns out to be any good or not, and I've got no idea, and I hope really that we'd barely see him, to be honest, because it will mean that Kieran Tierney is fit and ready for 38 Premier League games, which is what I want to see next season. So if we barely see this guy, I'm fine with that. But even if he doesn't work out, if he turns out to be crap or a problem or whatever it is, at least you can say, well, we tried to do it the right way or a better way than we have in the past.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you stand a very good chance of getting your money back on him, kind of whatever happens. I think with the pedigree he'll have, having, you know, come through at Arsenal, as it were, or come through us for a few years. And, you know, there is a logic to bringing in a Portuguese-speaking defender, especially on the left-hand side. He might have Gabriel there next to him. There's a little Portuguese-speaking gang at Arsenal, as we know, for better and worse. So we'll slot right into that. I think it's a really interesting one. I think, you know, it's something we all wanted to see addressed. We wanted it done in January, really. The fact that we didn't arguably cost us, but the reason we didn't is we felt we couldn't get the right kind of player in the right kind of profile. It seems at least we have sort of belatedly done that now. So, yeah, I'm intrigued to see little bits and pieces of him. I imagine that'll be primarily in the cup games, you'd think.
Yeah, I mean, depending on how many we have.
Second round League Cup game we're also excited about.
yeah.
Which for the first time in forever. Glad, you know, it's a long list of stuff and that feels like we're very close to ticking one off there.
What else? I mean, I suppose we have to have the inevitable William Saliba conversation.
I think so. I mean, yeah, so the story came out from David about Marseille potentially being the destination. I have to be honest, there was a sort of outpouring, as is often the case under David's tweets, an outpouring of alarm and sort of shock almost at this story, which really surprised me because I think the reporting has been pretty consistent that since the Ben White interest emerged, that probably meant Saliba was going to go out again.
Yeah, but I think it was also predicated on some previous stories, you know, which said that Saliba was going to get a chance in preseason. And I think people got invested in that, to be honest. You know, I would say that, you know, given the fact that Saliba's agent was in London Highbury last House. Week in Highbury House, had a meeting with Edu. Was Mikel Arteta there? I'm not sure. I don't quite know who was in that meeting, but the fact that this has come out so quickly afterwards suggests to me anyway that the club have had a pretty good idea of what they wanted to do with William Saliba all along. Mm-hmm. Not a case that they sat down and went, well, we see how he's played with Nice. It feels to me anyway like this was always going to be the plan. And like you say, the Ben White thing has obviously played into that. When you're going to buy another central defender, there isn't room at the inn for everybody, so somebody's got to go. So I think, you know, maybe that frustration was because a lot of people believed he was going to get a chance in preseason. I'm not sure that was ever really the case. How do you view that? Does that, you know, the fact that the club have a good idea of what they want to do, whether you agree with it or not, they've been decisive, right? I feel, you know, myself, that I'm kind of glad they're sorting this out now rather than it running on all summer because, you know, the online discourse, which I know isn't necessarily representative of everything, has become so polarized around this player, you know, this young 20-year-old central defender who people, I think, you know, bought into the idea that he was going to be some kind of defensive savior because you pay 28 million quid for a defender and an 18-year-old and you're thinking, well, you know, this has got to be special. This has got to be because a club like Arsenal doesn't pay that kind of money for that kind of player without very good reason. Increasingly, I think there's something, and I've said this before, I think there are things about this situation that we're not aware of, but I'm kind of glad that if they are going to loan him out again, they've done it now, or, well, they're close to doing it now, and we can sort of tick this off and keep an eye on him and all the rest, but it isn't going to play out across the rest of what remains of the transfer window.
No, and I think it's worth adding as well, there were some reports, I think, from L'Equipe about a purchase clause being inserted for Marseille, which I don't think have any. That, no, I don't think that has any basis, in fact. I don't think that's the situation. I think it's going to be a pure loan deal. If there's any purchase that's kind of related to it. I wonder if it might be to do with Matteo Guendouzi. You know, you wonder if it's kind of a case of, well, if you pay up for the one guy, you can have the other. Well, it's interesting that both those players seem to be headed to the same destination anyway.
Well, I've got a question on that now for a second. Yeah. I'll give you that one now in a sec. But yeah, go on.
I was going to say, yeah, I think it's true that we can infer that Arsenal have a pretty clear idea of what they want to do. I think we can probably also infer that maybe Saliba has quite a clear idea of what he wants to do. You know, I'm not sure how enthusiastic he would be about coming back to Arsenal and being, you know, third or fourth choice centre-back and not developing, not playing games. I actually don't think that would be in his best interests. So I think everyone's kind of a similar mind about this situation. I mean, listen, I don't want to be a hypocrite because I went and watched Saliba at St Etienne and I thought this is a really talented player who can make a massive contribution to Arsenal in the coming years. And I still think that. What I do have to say is none of us know how he would fare in the Premier League.
Does that make you wonder whether a loan to Marseille is the best option or not? How much can a club insist, for example, you know, when there are loan offers for a player and we believe there are a couple from France, maybe a couple from the Premier League, you know, can Arsenal say, no, we don't want you to go to France. We want you to go and play for Newcastle in the Premier League so we can see what you're doing in the Premier League? Or is, you know, what a player wants and how... Like, if Saliba really doesn't want to go to Newcastle and we force him to go to Newcastle, are you really getting a true representation of the player? Because you're immediately putting him into an environment which is uncomfortable. He doesn't want to be there. He's not happy. That's going to play on how he trains, how he performs, et cetera, et cetera. Like, surely, while I see the logic of saying we should make him go on loan to a Premier League club, what a player actually wants... And remember, he's still only 20 with loads of time to develop. What a player wants is surely a really big factor in this, because if he goes to Marseille, I know it might be comfortable, etc. But, you know, if he's happy and he plays well and he plays often and he develops, is that not the ideal scenario for a loan deal like this for a player of his age?
Well, if you'd asked me a few weeks ago, I probably would have said, oh, yeah, I'll pick a Premier League team, ideally.
Yeah.
But when you think about it, I mean, they say Newcastle. They've been mentioned in dispatches. We've just sent Joe Willock to Arsenal.
Newcastle.
And all we're saying is, well, he did well, but we don't know if that's a good fit. There's such a different style of team. How do we know how he would work in the Arsenal 11? And, you know, I think the same might be said of Saliba. You know, you hear people say... Oh, Rob Holding would have done well at Newcastle because he's sort of a deep defender. I mean, we know they're a very stylistically different team. And actually, I think Marseille are managed by Sampaoli, the former Chile manager, who, like Arteta, is a bit of a Bielsa disciple, probably a manager Arteta knows and admires. I think that maybe Marseille is a better fit. If you're looking at him and thinking, how can he translate that to what Arteta wants to do? I mean, you know, if you ask me straight up, do I think Saliba's coming back to Arsenal next summer and going to be part of the first team squad? I think that does become a really difficult question. I mean, it's really hard to know at this stage how serious the club are about integrating him at any point. But he is on a long enough deal that they can afford this season out on loan. I think he'll have 2 years when he gets back. And can make a decision then. And who knows what position the club will be in, what position the manager will be in. You know, if Edu is looking after the future of the club, I don't think he should be selling William Saliba because he may have a contribution to make down the line. I mean, he is still so young. And how many Premier League teams are hanging their hat on a 19, 20-year-old central defender?
Well, that's it. I mean, the only name you ever hear is Fofana, and I get it. He did well at Leicester. He's a good player, but, you know, they did concede more goals with him in the team last season. So there is a price to pay for young defenders. I'm not saying that Saliba couldn't come in and, you know, contribute to Arsenal or play well or whatever it is, but, you know, I just
and
can't.
I think when they brought Fofana in, by the way, they were playing four at the back primarily, and they still had Evans and Soyuncu. So I don't think they envisaged kind of coming to rely on him or using him quite as much as they did. He did very well and he did excel. And who knows, Saliba may do the same.
I mean, look,
won't know though for 12 months.
There's just so much anger over this one. I just can't get angry about to the extent that some people are. You know, he is a 20-year-old central defender. They have a lot to learn at that age. You know, I see people say stuff like, well, Tony Adams was captain at 20 years of age, but Tony Adams wasn't the finished article at 20 by any means. Mm. You know, he lived in an environment, a footballing environment, where there was much less, I'm not going to say less scrutiny, but not everything you did would become, you know, a GIF or a meme or a video. Like, every single thing that footballers do is under the microscope these days. It is different for 20-year-olds now than it was for 20-year-olds in the early 80s when Tony Adams was breaking through. You know, it's not the same kind of thing. And I get the whole, if you're good enough, you're old enough. I absolutely get it. But, you know, I just, as a deal, you know, we've paid £28 million for a player who's not going to play for us for three seasons. And I think if you're going to be angry about the deal itself, I think that's fair enough. I really do, because it's a big waste of resources, particularly that summer of 2019, when you think what 28 million might have got us in terms of an established central defender. You know what I mean?
And actually that summer, there were people within Arsenal who felt that you know, I think that was the summer we spent big on Pepe as well.
Yeah.
I think there were people saying some of that resource should have been allocated to signing a first-team ready centre-half.
Yeah, particularly as the Koscielny thing was going on in the background.
Blowing up, yeah.
You know, that was going on, and then, like, they manufactured this scenario where David Luiz comes in. You know, I think there's more to that summer
so far
than we know.
So far, it's obviously not money well spent.
No.
I do think if you're going to say, well, you know, there may be a long-term view here, then you have to leave open the possibility that in 5, 6, 7 years' time, that 28 million does look like a reasonable investment. If Saliba does integrate and does contribute through his 20s, in his prime, then you say, okay, you know, fair play. A decade on, that does look like decent money. But we have no idea if that's going to happen. And personally, I'm not especially confident that it will.
Like, if I gave you £100 right now,
yeah,
and the bet was William Saliba will play for Arsenal next season, how much of that £100 would you be willing to wager on that happening?
I think he will play. Probably I'd be like 30%. Something like that, you know. I would sway towards not. And part of that is just a sense of, like, I've never found anything Arteta has said publicly particularly convincing on Saliba. Even when he said he'll come back and be assessed, I was always thinking, you know, well, that doesn't mean, a lot of people took that as he's coming back. But to me, it just meant, well, yeah, he's scheduled to return to.
I mean, what's the thought process behind the decision making? Like, they've come to the decision without preseason starting again. They don't feel like they need to see him up close and personal to decide what they want to do with him. And, you know, some people will say it's mismanagement. Other people will say, well, they're trying to manage the career of a 20-year-old defender who needs to play more regularly to actually become the defender everyone wants him to be, right? So what's the thought process or the decision-making process? There's a guy who is the loan manager called Ben Napper. I mean, he's obviously in contact with the players who are out on loan. He's assessing the performances. He's producing, I imagine he's producing, you know, dossiers or whatever. I don't know. But, like, a PowerPoint presentation or whatever the fuck, you know, to highlight how William Saliba did at Nice during his loan spell there. So the strengths, the weaknesses, what's good, what's bad, etc., etc. So You know, that has to play a part in this. It's not simply a case that, you know, one person has said, well, no, I don't like his face. Let's get him out of here.
No, there must be a process there. And, you know, you'd think video would be involved in that, watching his games, tracking his performances. I don't think there's been masses of contacts between, you know, Arteta and Saliba since he went out on loan.
Mm.
But then that's not especially unusual. I mean, you know, that's been the case with quite a few players. It does just seem that this was a decision that was taken a little while ago. I mean, if you think about the order in which rumours have broken or Arsenal's interest in players appears to have accelerated, Ben White kind of led the charge, didn't it? You know, and a lot of people were angry about that. Why are we going for a centre-half first, seemingly? And I think, you know, the fact that we were making moves towards a Ben White deal that early in the window suggests we absolutely knew what Saliba's fate would be.
Do you think it's going to be an issue for Ben White if and when he does sign that there are going to be people who resent his presence in the team because, you know, they would have preferred to see William Saliba get a run, or they're invested in the Saliba story, etc.
Every time he makes a mistake, it'll be like, oh, you know, we spent 50 million on this guy and we had Saliba.
Mm.
I actually think he'll be okay for two reasons. Number one is that fans love signings and they desperately want signings to succeed. I think that's in part why there is so much feeling around Saliba. We invest in the idea of these players. By the time the deals happen, we've talked ourselves into them. And I think that will be true for Ben White as well. I also think the fact that stylistically he's quite a different player will serve him well in that regard. You know, I think, you know, Saliba's a different body type, different sort of shape as a defender. And I think that will help avoid direct comparisons. But yeah, it'll be, I think it'll be the manager actually who comes under fire, and maybe Edu and the club more generally.
Right.
If Ben White doesn't work out and Saliba is Liga player of the year, I think it's the club who will get it in the neck.
All right. Here's a question from the Discord from, just increase the font size, Malik Bergman, who says, hi, folks. I'm not sure about you, but I can't shake the image of Matteo Guendouzi as evil Kermit whispering into Saliba's ear next season at Marseille. Are you concerned at all about their relationship and how it may impact Saliba and his feelings towards Mikel Arteta and Arsenal? Obviously, if people aren't aware, it looks like Matteo Guendouzi is going to join Marseille, and Saliba could go to Marseille. We know that Guendouzi was unceremoniously dumped by Mikel Arteta, probably not that well disposed towards the manager. Would you have concerns that he might be just poisoning his mind?
I mean, pure speculation, but I don't know how much help, you know, Saliba will need getting to those conclusions. I think there's probably, you know, there's a lot of water under the bridge already between him and the manager, one suspects. And I do worry about it a little bit. I remember, you know, these things get blown out of proportion, but I remember some sort of social media interaction between the two that implied a kind of, you know, brothers in arms spirit. It was probably blown out of proportion, but it was something like one of the players said, you know, I'm free or something, when they managed to go out on loan and somebody liked it. Or I don't know. There was something that people on the internet managed to infer.
Oh, I remember this. It was when Saliba went on loan and there was a picture of Mikel Arteta dressed up as a prison guard and he was, you know, he was chaining them up.
And he was beating him, wasn't he? He was beating him, yeah.
No, I know what you mean.
No, I don't know. But do I worry about that? A little bit. But I think they are different cases. I mean, Guendouzi, you know, I think whatever the structure or organisation of that deal is going to be in such a way that he ain't coming back. I think with Saliba, the door is, if not open,
ajar.
Yeah.
I like the idea of Guendouzi as evil Kermit. It's quite a good one. But yeah, look, there's two things. One, I suppose, is that, you know, Saliba is a man with a mind of his own, regardless of, you know, whatever is said to him by somebody else. Just because your friend doesn't like something doesn't mean that you can't or have to dislike it too. Although I could see good reasons as to why he might not. I suppose the other one is, like, if it's only a concern if there is a plan to reintegrate Saliba next summer. So it may be, and I do maybe think
you make a good point about him having a mind of his own.
Yeah.
You know, I think that we shouldn't put this all on the club entirely. I think, you know, it's very possible that the player himself is like, I want to go and I want to play. And, you know, I think whatever you think of him, his chances of coming straight into the Arsenal first 11 and playing 38 games, probably fairly slim.
Mm, whereas he could play week in, week out for Marseille. So we'll see.
Yeah.
We'll see. Look, people, Arsenal fans will be keeping a very close eye on what happens in Ligue 1 with Marseille, Matteo Guendouzi to a small extent, but obviously William Saliba.
Absolutely. I've got some sad news for you, Andrew, by the way, that's just broken.
Okay.
You're going to be reeling from this. I hope you're going to be okay. Our set piece coach has left.
Gone to the great free kick wall in the sky.
Kicked into touch in the sky. He died of death by a thousand short corners, they said.
Well, I mean, we were, I think, defensively good from set pieces. No, I mean, that was an improvement. We didn't concede many goals from corners. How much of that was down to him, I'm not 100% sure. I think what we can say is that our attacking set pieces don't make me cry any tears over this one. As long as we can maintain the defensive improvement, if we can bring somebody else in.
He's gone to Malmo to work with them. I'm not sure exactly in what capacity. I think defensively we were good on set pieces now, and I think he should get credit for that.
Mm.
I think in attacking terms, there's probably room for improvement.
For sure.
But it'll be interesting to see if he's replaced directly. You know, will we bring in another specialist?
I think we have Nicolas Jover has come in from Manchester City. So Mikel Arteta has gone back to his old stomping ground. Charles Watts reporting that we've gone for this guy. So that'll be interesting. Oh, he previously worked with
ex-Brentford coach, by the way, Nicolas Jover.
Everybody's ex-Brentford these days, aren't they?
Let's just buy Brentford and be done with it.
Things beginning to happen. Anything else you want to touch on? I mean, what about the Guendouzi to Marseille move? Not the actual structure of it, because I've got a question about that. We can deal with that in part two. But, like, the move for Guendouzi himself, it doesn't appear that too many other teams were interested. We have made a small profit on him, so...
Yeah. I mean, barely, I imagine, once you factor in the wages and stuff. But, yeah, I think it's an odd one, Guendouzi. It's a really odd one. I mean, I know you were always slightly more circumspect in your assessment of the player, I think. You know, I do think the internet went a bit wild with Guendouzi at one stage, and I do think sometimes his ability was overstated. But, you know, clearly he is a talented player and a big, big character, and I think that will work for him to a certain extent in the course of his career. I think it's also going to cause him problems, and, you know, it remains to be seen if he sort of becomes, you know, Roy Keane or Joey Barton, basically. How is that channeled?
Well, he's definitely not becoming Roy Keane. No chance. He's not even close
in terms of talent.
But
I
do know what you mean. Like,
is he able to channel that appropriately?
Yeah.
Not. I mean, Joey Barton had a lovely time in Marseille, so maybe.
Yeah, there you go.
It is a good move.
No, I mean, I see stuff like, you know, he was worth 40 million last year and now we're only selling him for 10 million. I'm like, he was never worth 40 million. There's no way.
Well, the thing is, if he was, you know, when he was at the height of his value, probably after his first season, right, where he was bit of a breakout star under Unai Emery. The reality is, I reckon a lot of those people complaining about that wouldn't have countenanced selling him at that time. So, you know, it's easy to go, well, he was worth whatever he was worth then, but you probably wouldn't have done the deal. So it doesn't matter, essentially. I think, you know, he's probably worth a bit more than what we've got, I imagine, but he is sort of damaged goods. You know, he's, as we had the conversation on here, whatever it was, a week
last
ago.
Last week, yeah.
Yeah, you know, he's a player people know we don't want. And, you know, that's an issue. And he probably has a bit of a patchy reputation, to be honest, within the game, I mean, by this point.
It doesn't seem like there was a long list of clubs banging down the door to try and sign him either. And that has an impact on you know, the price that you get for a player. So,
yeah, I mean, I remember when he first was leaving the club, there was talk of kind of Barcelona, you know, and that's never materialised.
Not even there.
I mean, at the end of the day,
you
will pay
stupid.
The price for being completely unable to head the ball.
Oh, it's ridiculous. Ridiculous.
I wish we'd got more money for him. I do. It would have been helpful.
Mm.
But equally, I sort of don't care.
Yeah, look, I think this is one of the things that we had to do this summer. We had to, you know, get rid of certain players. He is one of the players that was very obviously going to go. It looks like that is, you know, pretty much done at this point. So just check it off the list and get on with the other stuff that we have to do. You know, we keep talking about how much there is to do, and the more we do, you know, the more we can focus on some of the more important things as well. So,
Again, a long list, something ticks off.
All right, will we take a break? We've got plenty of questions, so we can crack into those in part two. How about that?
That sounds good.
All right, we'll be right back with your questions and more in part two after this.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome back to the Arscast Extra. This is part two of the show where we answer questions that you send to us on Twitter at GunnarBlog and at ArsBlog, and also on the ArsBlog Discord chat server, which you get access to if you are an ArsBlog member on Patreon. James, we were just talking about Matteo Guendouzi, and he has posted a farewell to Arsenal on his Instagram account.
Oh, my word. Is it as emotional and moving as his farewell to Unai Emery, or his congratulations to Unai Emery?
It's not quite as weird.
Florid.
Florid is a great word. But it is just a thank you for everything I discovered and learned so much during my time here. It would be impossible to list everything without forgetting one memory or word, but I will never forget any minute spent with the Gunners jersey, blah, blah, blah. Thanks for the good times, the bad times. I can only wish the best to the club and its fans who deserve so much. Trust me. Goodbye, Arsenal. I will never forget and will be a Gooner forever. So that pretty much tells you that that deal is done and dusted. Matteo Guendouzi going to Marseille on loan with an obligation to buy. So we have a couple of questions around that. One comes from Radiohead Tim, who's at Radiohead Tim on Twitter. And he says, we have agreed two loan deals with obligations to buy next season. Do we not need any money this season? Or are we looking to pay in installments for our incoming deals? What do you make of deals like this one? I think we spoke about it before, didn't we? That because of the financial impact of COVID, clubs are looking for a season with fans, with ticket sales, with merchandise, with all the revenue that you generate from having fans back in the stadiums to sort of fund transfers next season, if you like. So kicking the financial can down the road a little bit.
What's the other one we've done? Sorry for
Well, Mavropanos has gone to Stuttgart,
yes.
And I think, I'm not sure it's an obligation, or it may well be an obligation, but it is
I think
one
it's
of
a
those.
Very attractive option, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like, it seems likely that will happen. I mean, I think this is probably less to do with what money Arsenal have and more to do with what money clubs in Europe don't have.
Yeah.
And certainly with Marseille, that seems to be the case, that, you know, this is essentially creative accounting, you know, a way of sort of saying you'll pay for the player but not having to do it right away. And I think Arsenal probably know that given the revenues they have, the season ticket money, etc., coming back into the club, the huge TV revenue they have compared to other European clubs, even without Champions League or Europa League football, they're probably in a healthy enough position that they can afford to wait. And actually, they're better off waiting 12 months and getting a decent return, although whether or not it's decent could be debated, than getting less this summer.
Mm.
And yes, I mean, in answer to the other question, I think Arsenal, of course, are going to look to use to spread payments over deals, as they always do. You know, it's very, very rare that you go in up front and pay cash, as it were.
Only if you're doing a release clause like Partey, you know?
Exactly, yeah, which, I mean, Arsenal did do. And how are Arsenal going to do that? Almost certainly by borrowing money. You know, I mean, there's no other way that Arsenal can spend significantly this summer. So,
well,
if you're
one
of those fans.
There is one other way.
Yes.
Which is the owner funding the transfer.
The gift from, from an owner.
But I don't believe that's what's going to happen. So.
No, I stand by my. There's only one other possible. There's only one possible.
Yeah, fair enough.
But I think, and you know, if you're the kind of fan who's inclined to be concerned about loading debt or, you know, the club borrowing money, then I think there is going to be reason after this transfer window to be worried about that, because Arsenal are going to have to do that. I guess they just see that as a given, the fact that the Kroenkes aren't inclined to necessarily gift.
Yeah.
Money to the club. I guess they must see that as a necessary step.
So do you see these kind of deals becoming a bit more common?
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, I find the sort of wording of it interesting, you know. Like, what is to stop them just calling it a permanent deal, really, with Guendouzi? Because it sort of is.
Mm.
It's just when the payment actually happens. I mean, I guess there's kind of a quirk in the player registration in that he will technically belong to Arsenal for another 12 months. But I do think a lot of deals like this will happen. And, you know, just like with Nicola Pepe, Arsenal paid £72 million, but it's not like they paid very much of that up front.
Mm.
So I think it's inevitable. And I think that if you're selling players to the continent, you're up against it this summer. And we had this conversation about, is that why there's a certain degree of sense in investing in English or Premier League players? Because your chances of selling them on to an English club might be better, and then you might actually get some money for them.
Mm.
I mean, yeah, it's tough if you're trying to sell to a French team right now.
Exactly. You know, particularly as the money given the TV situation in France is difficult as well, isn't it? If, for example, let's imagine you're a club in Italy right now and you're thinking about Lucas Torreira, for example.
Yeah.
Are you going to go to Arsenal? I mean, Arsenal have demonstrated to the market that they are amenable to doing this kind of a deal. Does that leave you more open to those kind of offers? Are transfers like this more complicated than, you know, here's 10 million, we'll offer you 10 million. Okay, we accept. There you go. Pay us the money, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, are they any more complex, or is it just a question of just arranging? It takes a little bit more arranging financially.
Yeah, they are hugely complex. And actually, oftentimes that's kind of a lot of the negotiation is, you know, okay, you're going to buy the player. We know the player wants to join you.
Mm.
We're amenable to a deal. But what are the terms of that deal? You know, even if you've got... Look at Ben White as a great example. You know, everyone knows the price tag on Ben White's head is basically 50 million quid. But the sort of how and the how of that 50 million quid and the when is kind of the bit to be negotiated, the bit that takes a lot of time and back and forth. And it's about finding, you know, when, especially when clubs need to sell or want to sell, it's about finding the right structure that makes them happy. That is affordable. And, you know, I think that in all Arsenal's negotiations this summer that I know about, that is a big part of it. And to be honest, the primary reason for delay in a lot of these instances. You know, I think Arsenal are going to get Ben White. I think Arsenal are going to get Lokonga. But I think it's just about figuring out exactly how. And maybe those conversations and maybe those discussions have greater importance now with the world in the financial state that it is than at any point previously.
Maybe so. There was one on the Discord here as well. It comes from Arsenal FCTX, who said, James said on Twitter he's going to look into the difference between a loan with an obligation to buy versus selling the player outright with a or multiple deferred payments. My suspicion has to do with the player's contract and how he's paid until he's owned outright by the loanee or the buying club. But I'd love to know what you found out, if you found out anything since that tweet.
Yeah, well, I only said that yesterday and I haven't actually looked into it much yet. But his point, or their point rather, is very good. Because maybe it is the case that Arsenal are making a contribution towards Guendouzi's salary for this final year of his contract.
Hope not. I mean, that should be manageable. I mean, Guendouzi arrived 4 years ago, or 3 years ago now, as a young player from France. Yeah. Like, his salary and his wages wouldn't have been so outrageous, would they?
Was there a second deal? Okay, fair enough in that case. No, I mean, I wouldn't think that's particularly high in that instance. But, I don't know. That, like I say, I'm interested in as to what exactly the reason is that Marseille would need it to be one and not the other. And I will try to find out, because I think we're going to hear more about this type of transfer.
Mm.
Here's a question that's not about Arsenal. So, good day, gents. What are your thoughts on the various manager appointments that have been made over the last week? Do you think Nuno or Benitez will improve Spurs or Everton to any degree that will cause Arsenal problems? And then after that, I've got some questions about Patrick Vieira at Crystal Palace. But let's start with Nuno and Benitez.
I think Nuno is not as good a manager as some of the names that Tottenham have been linked with. Like, Conte was genuinely a bit like, oh, I don't like that. I don't like the sound of that. But I do remember down the years, quite a number of times, Tottenham have appointed a manager and you think, ooh, that's quite good. But then the inherent Tottenham of Tottenham kicks in. You know what I mean? It sort of is a great equalizer. It doesn't matter who they're like. Even Mourinho, you think, well, there's a guy with a track record of winning trophies, regardless of where he is. He wins trophies. He'll win them something. And, you know, it ended the way it ended. So I think we have to look at the Spurs DNA being the most powerful force in nature. So, you know, Nuno is not particularly an attacking coach, is he? And that flies in the face of what Daniel Levy was saying about the kind of football Tottenham want to play. So leave him on. Let's see what happens there. I think Rafa Benitez, leaving aside all the emotion that Everton fans have about it, an understandable emotion that they have about it, I think is a good appointment for them.
Are they unhappy, Everton fans?
About appointing a former Liverpool manager. Yeah.
Are they? Yeah. I mean, genuinely, I am slightly surprised by that. I know, obviously, he's got the association with Liverpool, but he's worked elsewhere in the Premier League. He loves that city. I think he lives most of the time in that city, or certainly has a home there. And I think that is a really good appointment. I think he will improve Everton.
Yeah, I think so too. But I understand completely why they... why they might not want him, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I get that. But I think they'll soon warm to him if he gets results.
Mm.
I don't think Nuno moves the needle much for Spurs at all,
no,
to be honest.
Same.
And I think, well, they played very attractive football in the Championship, his Wolves side. Very, very good.
But they were bringing in Premier League quality players to
play
in the
They were the best team in that league by a mile.
Yeah.
And in the Premier League, yeah, I think they were more known as a kind of counter-attacking outfit who kept games extremely tight. I mean, weirdly, although Spurs talk about themselves as this kind of great attacking team, I think their most successful football generally has been kind of counter-attacking. If I think about Pochettino's teams and even Mourinho's results in big games when things were going better for him, you know, they've always had, if you've got people like, you know, Son and Bergwijn and others who can break at pace, I think I can see, you know, that stylistically, there is a fit there for Nuno. I'm just not sure it's a fit that Spurs fans will particularly enjoy.
No, I mean, I think this idea of the kind of football they play harks back to 1961.
Exactly.
To the last time they won the league.
At least ours is in this century, do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Is it? It is, yeah.
But yeah, so I'm not especially worried about that appointment. Mm. I would have been worried about a Conte, like you say. I would have quite liked the guy, was it Fonseca? He just seemed very kind of meh. Nuno, I think, has always seemed like quite a nice man. So that's disappointing that I now have to hate him and sing songs about his mother. But yeah, aside from that, I'm not too worried. But what about Patrick Vieira? So Ollie Tucker also asked feelings on seeing Vieira at Palace. And then Alan Rennie said, what would Patrick Vieira need to achieve at Palace to make him a serious contender next time Arsenal require a manager?
That's a great question. I mean,
pleased to see him in the Premier League.
Yeah, I'm curious to see how he gets on. I think it's really interesting to see him get a job in the Premier League. You know, if you watch Liga, you can see what he did in his previous job. If you're into MLS, you know what he did over there. But, you know, Premier League is bread and butter for most of us in terms of the kind of football experience that we have. So, yeah, I'm really interested to see what he does. I think he's got a big job in his hands. Palace have a fairly strange squad, don't they, in terms of the age profiles of a lot of players, the contractual situations with a lot of players. He must have had some assurances that he's going to be able to reshape the squad to some level or another. I mean, what is a successful season for Palace? Where did they finish last year?
Well,
let me have a look.
Mid-table, I think. Let's have a look. Premier League table. They didn't have a great season, basically. I mean,
right, they finished 14th on 44 points, so, you know, a good way clear of the relegation places. But they were particularly low, weren't they, this year? The relegated teams, Fulham, 28 points. You know, they talk about you needing 40 points to be safe normally in the Premier League, and you would have been safe at 29. So the bar was quite low.
I mean, what's realistic?
What is realistic? Yeah, I mean, a couple of places higher than that, maybe. Top 10 finish, maybe. Oh, that would be a brilliant achievement for
that would be hard.
For any Crystal Palace manager to get them into the top 10, I think would be a fantastic achievement. So, you know, what would he realistically have to do to be in contention? I don't know, actually. I don't know how you gauge that particular metric.
Very hard, isn't it?
I mean, yeah. Like, do they attack? Do you try and, you know, build an attacking team? Do you be pragmatic and realistic and think, okay, we're a team that's not going to have as much possession? Does that...
That was going to be my suggestion, you know, rather than league places or results, maybe it's about... Because Crystal Palace have had a very clear identity under Roy Hodgson, but one that was ultimately quite uninspiring for their supporters.
Mm.
Although it was very pragmatic and I would argue pretty effective and kept them in the Premier League multiple times. But if, you know, I think they're at a stage, they're at that slightly dangerous, stokey stage in their development where they kind of yearn for something more, I think if Vieira can create a new identity for Crystal Palace, and it's one that's clear, which apparently is what he did when he was working in America quite effectively, he actually developed a real style of play relatively swiftly, I think that might stand him in as good a stead as anything else. I mean, obviously he's got to keep them in the league, but if he can show that he can, you know, construct a team identity and play with a certain style, I think that might, you know, chime a few chords with the Arsenal hierarchy. But it's a really tricky one. I mean, how it's very difficult to assess a manager who's never really had the kind of job that you'd be offering him, you know? It's...
Yeah, but then we appointed a guy who had no job whatsoever. So, you know, there's no... it's not like there is a precedent.
In that respect.
Yeah, for sure, you know? So, look, I think people will be able to judge the work that Patrick Vieira does at Crystal Palace in the context of Crystal Palace in the Premier League next season, how they play, you know, it'll all play out. People will be able to make their own minds up on what kind of a job he is doing there. But until such time as it happens, you know, it's really difficult to predict because we don't know what kind of playing squad he's going to have. You know, what his, we've spoken about this plenty of times, though, like what a manager wants and what he's capable of, and I don't mean just individually what he is capable of, what he can produce with the kind of squad that he has plays a big part in the kind of football that a team plays. Like, you could have, you know, I want to go in, I want to play short, passing, free-flowing, attacking football, but I've got 19 lads who look like Ryan Shawcross. You know, you're not going to be able to fucking do it. You know, regardless of how well you could teach that or coach that, you are restricted by what you've got in your squad. So maybe it'll be down to what Palace do in the market this summer.
What do you think this means, if anything, for Patrick Vieira's involvement with the Daniel Ek kind of takeover?
Yeah, there was a question from James Anderson, who's at JamesYah77 on Twitter, says, what implications will Patrick Vieira's appointment at Crystal Palace have on Daniel Ek's proposed takeover bid, given that he was part of the Invincible team that supported the takeover? I mean, it means that Patrick Vieira is no longer associated with that, I guess.
I don't think he can be, can he?
No.
You know, I think it's a conflict of interest, basically. I think there's rules about that.
But, I mean, it might suggest something about... Like, it's all gone very quiet, hasn't it, on the Daniel Ek front. So whether that's because he's biding his time and waiting for something to happen or, you know...
Well, I think he's waiting for something to happen that probably isn't going to happen. I think they're waiting for the Kroenke's position to change. And that's not going to happen this summer, is it?
I mean, there are scenarios where another Daniel Ek approach might be more opportune, if you like. Like, I obviously don't want this to happen, but if Arsenal are in a really bad position mid-season and the season has gone terribly, then such is the depth of feeling about, you know, the situation we'll find ourselves in, that it would be a good time for Daniel Ek or anyone else to sort of show their hand again. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I mean, I would prefer if we had a good season next season, you know, first and foremost.
If we take Daniel Ek at his word, he's playing the long game. And I guess who knows where Patrick Vieira will be in a year or 2 years or 3 years. But for the time being, I think we can sort of assume he's not attached to that.
Yeah.
So, interesting.
Good luck to Patrick Vieira for, you know, 36 games next season.
exactly. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of narrative there. Two former Arsenal captains in the dugout when we faced Palace. I'm really pleased for him. I said I'm putting a lot of hunches out there. I said one about Roberto Martinez earlier, but emotionally, I would love to see Patrick Vieira as Arsenal manager. It would be fantastic for me because he was, you know, such a player I grew up idolising. He was the heartbeat of the team that I love more than any other. Do I know if he's got the requisite qualities, if he's the right guy? I don't really know, to be honest, but be some story. So I'll definitely be keeping a close eye on him.
Yeah, exactly. That's why, you know, him managing in England, it does in some way bring him a step closer.
It's like we've sent him on loan to Newcastle, you know. We can see how he copes.
Here's a question from Sam Paulman, who says, if Camavinga is available for 30 million, should we not be interested, young and with plenty of upside? And the Arsenal scout at the Arsenal scout says, why are we wasting our time on guys like Ben White for 50 million who don't really improve our first 11 relative to their cost when we have the opportunity to sign Camavinga for 30 million. He's an Arsenal fan. I'm not sure if that's true, but he says guaranteed starter, incredible upside, obvious move.
Yeah. I'm just not sure if we do have that opportunity.
I agree. You know? I don't think we do when they're... What's his option? Manchester United, Champions League...
Probably a higher salary.
Or Arsenal.
Yeah. Champions League versus no European football, that's a tough battle for us to win. You know,
mm-hmm.
We've got London, but that's about it. And I think he's a top prospect, and I think if Arsenal felt they could sign him, they probably would. That's basically what I think.
Yeah. I don't think we've got any chance.
Yeah.
I'm not, you know, if we can pay 50 million for Ben White, we can pay 30 million for Camavinga. But I just don't believe.
Oh, the 30 million's not a problem. That's not a problem. But given the money that we appear to
that's
be
not the issue.
Or preparing to spend. But it's the player and his decision. I mean, you know, we're in a similar situation with Locatelli, right? The boy at Sassuolo who's. Wanted by Juventus.
Yeah.
And Arsenal are pretty serious about wanting that player. I think they have gone as far as certainly contacted the club. I don't know if there's been an official offer. I think that might be a little bit of bluster on behalf of the Italian president. But definitely it's a serious interest. But the player probably wants to go to Juventus. And there's sort of only so much you can do. When the player wants to go somewhere, they tend to get it, don't they?
Yeah, well, when one option is vastly superior to the other, you know, and it kind of hurts me to say that, but like if you're Locatelli and the option is Juventus or Arsenal right now, what are you choosing as an Italian midfielder?
Yeah,
what are
you
choosing?
Record domestically, you know, playing with Ronaldo. There's a lot going for you at Juve. But we have got. Gunnosaurus, obviously. You get to have your photo taken with Gunnosaurus.
Mm-hmm.
I hear the food in the canteen is quite good.
Look, it is just it's a reality that we're having to deal with, that our stock has fallen. And, you know, in order to get out of that, we're not going to be able to, like, who across Europe really wouldn't want to take a punt on Camavinga given his fairly obvious potential. It's not realized. He's still very young, but like there'd be a mountain of clubs if they could do it would try. Similarly with Locatelli, like, you know, why wouldn't, yeah, the options were not the most attractive option. And that is the reality. And that's the confines in which Mikel Arteta and Edu are going to have to work this summer. I don't fault the ambition or the intent to sign someone like Locatelli, but I do think it's basically impossible if the other option is Juventus.
Juve. Yeah, and people keep saying, why all these names? You know, why isn't there a clear strategy? I mean, I think the answer is basically because Arsenal don't have dibs. They don't have first choice on a lot of these players, so they have to hedge their bets slightly. Yeah, going to be interesting. I think Locatelli, to be honest, that's a pipe dream, I really think.
Mm.
Italian players, as a rule, will stay in Italy, given the choice. It seems to me, anyway. And Juve is a great move, like you say. What about this? Super white pill. Good morning, gents. What price do you think Aston Villa have to reach where Arsenal seriously start considering selling Smith Rowe?
17 trillion billion gazillion pounds. We had this conversation last week. My opinion on this matter has not changed one bit. We cannot and should not sell Emile Smith Rowe to Aston Villa. There's just no way we can do it.
I agree.
There isn't a price for Aston Villa. I mean, I know there's a price, right? There, of course, but like, there isn't also, you know?
Yeah.
It's just
isn't a price until they put that money on the table.
Yeah. It's just not possible.
It would be very, very, very bad.
Yeah. So, I mean, I had to, like, mute Birmingham Live on news now because I was just getting sick of fucking stories about this particular thing. But, you know, do you think we've been firm enough in our no?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Arsenal are absolutely unequivocal.
Okay, so are Villa just really annoying? Are they just really persistent and annoying?
Well, I think they've annoyed people. But I think, I mean, they're entitled to do whatever they want, aren't they?
Yeah.
It's interesting that sort of not, there hasn't been massive press about Villa's interest. You know, it's not like Villa are sort of coming out and, you know, it's not like there's quotes from their manager saying, of course, Emil Smith Rowe is a player we like and blah, blah, blah. I think they are conscious that this is an unwelcome approach. But I think they may have underestimated the degree to which it's unwelcome. And Arsenal, as far as I understand it, are completely unequivocal and have been completely unequivocal in their response. The player is not for sale. Who knows if Villa will try again? I did see some speculation. They may try again. I think they'll get the same answer, especially if they stay in this kind of ballpark. I mean, ultimately, I think their last offer was 30 million quid. Buendia, they signed for 33, rising to 38. He was playing in the Championship. He's not English. You know, he's not playing for a rival club, ostensibly. I think Villa would have to be, you know, they'd have to be in a different ballpark to even have a conversation with Arsenal.
Yeah. Look.
And I hope that doesn't happen.
Of course. Right. Here is a question from... Oh, where has it gone now? We have a couple, actually, slightly tactical questions from the Discord. Cluck, the rotisserie chicken, says, a back three seems to be the big trend at the Euros this year, and with us linked to a White, who has been deployed a lot in that system with Brighton, Tavares, who seems like a really interesting wing-back, who surely expects some game time. Do you think there's a chance Arteta could switch to a back three this season with Tierney as a left sided centre-back, like he plays for Scotland with Gabriel and Ben White? Personally, I don't like that system, but it might suit our players. While Atty, also on the Discord, says, do you think it's plausible we won't actually sign an out-and-out number 10 this window, much to the dismay of fans, and opt for a 4-3-3 instead of bringing in someone like Locatelli, or he says instead bringing in someone like Locatelli who can score goals from the number 8 position, or looking at Willock or Smith Rowe to play in that position? So a couple of interesting ones.
Yeah, interesting. I mentioned 3-4-3 or 3 at the back last week because when you watch the Euros, you see it implemented really successfully, and it doesn't... A lot of teams have done it really well. It doesn't have to be a kind of negative system. And I do wonder if there'll be a trend. I think a lot of teams will, not all the time, but will adopt it at points next season. It's just kind of an on vogue formation. And I think Arsenal, do we have the players in some respects? I mean, you know, we've certainly got enough centre-halves. We've got a great left wing-back in Kieran Tierney, potentially. He's also an option as a centre-back. Right-hand side, maybe if Bellerin goes, we don't necessarily have the ideal wing-back, but that might be something we address. I think it's something... I think we'll see Arsenal do it. I mean, the only thing I'd say is that I don't think it makes masses of difference at times in that, you know, we tend to build up with kind of two or three at the back. Like when Granit Xhaka plays in central midfield, when we build up, he's almost in there as the third centre-half at times. And I wonder if, you know, we might see more of that next season, obviously not with Xhaka. As for the number 10 thing, it's a tricky one, isn't it? Did you see Martin Odegaard's statement over the weekend?
I did. So that pretty much puts paid to...
Do you think so? I mean... When we reported that he's likely to stay at Madrid, now he's come out and said that. But I guess with Madrid, you just never quite know what they might do,
It feels a bit like you wouldn't put out that kind of statement unless you were given some serious assurances about, you know, what your role in the team or squad was, you know? So if the door were ajar, still, I think he would be a bit more circumspect. He probably wouldn't say anything like that, you know? It feels
or maybe
like
he's made the decision that if he does end up having to go, he wants to be playing Champions League. Or, you know, maybe so.
Yeah,
that's
also true.
We have to accept that as
a
possibility as well.
Yeah. I mean, Khalil Kearns, who's at Lord Khalil on Twitter, says, "Good morning, chaps. With the Odegaard deal off, Buendia, the guy who plays for AC Milan."
Whose name we can't say.
I can't. You should be able to say it.
Calhanoglu,
that's the guy. DePaul, all gone. Madison, too expensive. Our talk, non-existent this summer. Are we left with that horrible underlying fear that two of the bad things will happen? One, Willian stays. Two, we sign Coutinho.
I think... So the original question was, are we definitely going to get a number 10? And I'm wavering on that, I have to be honest. As in, I've always known or thought and written that that was the number one priority. But it just feels like things are really swinging in Emile Smith-Rowe's favour a little bit. You know, with the interest from Aston Villa and the kind of contract Arsenal are going to have to accordingly give him, maybe it does put you in a position where bringing in a £50 million number 10 on big money is a little bit problematic. I don't know because you know we managed to play Smith Rowe and Odegaard together, but I do wonder if it might change the type of signing we're looking for in that area of the pitch, if there might be a little bit more emphasis on Smith Rowe next season. And having, I think we do need someone who can, you know, rotate, cover, be an option there, but maybe it won't be the kind of marquee level that we'd necessarily been thinking. That's me thinking on the fly. I don't know that.
What if it's Bukayo Saka?
Yeah, I mean, that's the other question, is if you like what Nicola Pepe did last season, you know, where does that leave Saka? I mean, you want Pepe on the right, he can play from the left. Saka can play from the left. But then you've got Martinelli potentially to consider.
Going to the Olympics, though, so won't be around.
Yeah. I do still think we could do with another number 10, for sure. I just don't know who.
Are you slightly concerned that the start of our season is going to be impacted by internationals? In that, Gabriel is going to the Olympics. Brazil may not get all the way, but the final is on August the 7th, and they've got some good players. So Gabriel and Gabriel Martinelli will be at the Olympics. Bukayo Saka played more minutes than any other Arsenal player last season, apart from Bernd Leno and Granit Xhaka. He was second in outfield minutes. He's 19 years of age. He's gone away with England. I think we can see that there has been a benefit, you know, to him by doing that, right? I think the experience at the Euros, et cetera, will be great for him. You know, to have slotted in as one of the younger players in the squad. And for everyone, you see all the England players talking about how much they love him and what a great player he is and all that kind of stuff, right? So I think there are benefits to that, but we've got to give him a rest. We can't just sort of throw him back in. So if England go all the way to the final, that is, what's Sunday?
The 11th.
So he's going to need some holidays. Preseason starts on Wednesday. The rest of them are coming back on Wednesday. So Saka's going to need a couple of weeks' holidays, at least. Then he's going to need to come back and get up to speed in terms of, you know, fitness. And I know preseason is not quite what it was. You know, they're not going away, eating fish and chips and cakes and coming back and running off the extra stone that they put on over the holidays. I know it's not that anymore. But, you know, he is going to need some rest. Similarly, although he hasn't played for England, Ben White, he too is going to need a little bit of a rest, isn't he? A little bit of a holiday after a long season with Brighton, a season, you know, the European Championships with England. He's going to miss a significant portion of pre-season. He's got to come in, get settled, meet everybody. You know, there is, I'm not going to say a danger, but there is plenty to deal with over the opening weeks of the season.
Yes, that's a good point. I hadn't really considered that. I think
we're doomed.
Loss of Gabriel, huh?
We're doomed. Is that what you're saying?
We're doomed. Yeah, I think we're doomed.
I think we're pretty much doomed.
Gabriel is the one that would worry you. You know, but if you buy a £50 million centre half, you've got to believe they can come in and do a job. You know,
sure, but I just mean like he could come in. You know, let's England go to the final. He gets 3 weeks holidays. That takes him to the start of August. Our first match is on Friday the 13th.
Yeah.
You know, he's got to come, join a new club, meet everyone. I know, you know, it's
and
football.
We've got tough games.
Yeah, we've got tough games at the start of the season. So,
Also, ostensibly, he's been bought as a right-sided defender, you know, and Gabriel needs to be replaced on the left. And we've got Pablo Mari, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I do worry about that. We've also got the African Cup of Nations to contend with in January, which will present its own problems. Thomas Partey likely to go away. Pierrick Aubameyang.
Mohamed Elneny.
So that will be a challenge too. Yeah, I do worry about that. I worry generally about the start of the season. I think there's been an international tournament. That's never helpful in terms of cohesion.
Mm.
We've got hard games. And the manager's already under pressure.
Mm.
So I am nervous about it. very much so. But we shall see. I mean, I guess the more business they can get done sooner rather than later, the more it will help with that tricky start.
Yeah. Yeah.
Shall we have another question?
Why not?
Okay, let's. I'm just having a quick look for one there. We've had all that. Number 10. Who's number 10? Okay. Henkeho asks directly, do you think it's coming home or do you think Denmark will take the title for Eriksson? I don't think I should pass comment on this, but what do you think, Andrew?
Do I think it or do I fear it? No, look, I mean, it's really weird. You know, for an Irishman to, you know, see an England team with Tottenham's captain scoring the goals, you know, that's difficult to get behind.
Of course,
I love all my English friends and you and all of our English listeners, but sport is all about rivalries and things like that. I think England can win it. I definitely think they can win it. They've been maybe a bit uninspiring in the opening few games. But have England conceded a goal yet?
I don't know. They've certainly got the lowest kind of XG against. I mean, they barely give up any chances.
Mm.
And Jordan Pickford's actually had a really good tournament, as he tends to do. And
yeah.
It'd be crap for Everton for 2 years now.
Kane has, you know, scored a few goals now.
Awoken.
Raheem Sterling is excellent. You know, there's so much talent in there. When you think of Mount, you think of Foden, Saka, Grealish.
We remembered we've got Jadon Sancho the other day.
Jadon Sancho. Well, I mean, look, the only reason he started the other day is because he's a Man United player now, clearly.
Of course. Makes all the difference.
Yeah, exactly. It makes him 90% better because now he's with an English club. So, look, I think England can win it. I think they can win it. I mean, it's not going to be easy against Denmark. Like we said at the start, the story is really something, and I think perhaps overlooked in the romance, that's the wrong word, but you know what I mean? The emotional side of the Danish story is the fact that they're a good team. They're a good team with some good players, and I really loved the goal the other night. Kasper Dahlberg's goal, the pass with the outside of the right foot. It was like, what's his name? Mela? Is that how you say it?
Yeah, I think so.
He was infused with the spirit of Thomas Rosicki. Of course, Thomas Rosicki is still alive, but he just left his body for a moment to go into the Danish player to provide an assist against his own country. That one hasn't worked at all, but you know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean.
It was a very, very satisfying goal to watch. So I do think that, you know, aside from the emotion, Denmark have been very good. Then you have Spain and Italy, who are both obviously technically very good, potentially very difficult opponents. But, you know, I don't think they've been so good that England should be scared. Same as I said last time, they shouldn't be scared of Germany. So, yeah, it could very well come home. Mm. It could.
See. I don't know who out of... I think I'd rather play Spain than Italy. I just think there's something quite ominous about Italy. I think they look very good. Spain, I don't know. It's not the Spanish teams of the past, I would say.
No.
Even if they have played some very good stuff and scored, I think, more goals than anyone in the tournament. But yeah, there you go.
Okay, let's do one final one. It comes from Gary Hunt, who's at Mole Cheese on Twitter, which is one of the most disgusting cheeses there is. Mole cheese. You know.
It's an acquired taste.
It is. He said, is there any movement on Lacazette, either sale or contract? Are we really going to let a £50 million purchase walk out for free? It seems very Arsenal. And on the Discord, Bittersweet Tim, who says, good flying Saka morning, gents. What do you think about Lacazette's potential contract extension? And there is some chatter that there's going to be a one-year contract extension for Lacazette. I don't know how true that is, but yeah, what do you make of that situation?
It doesn't seem like there's loads of interest. You know, we're not hearing big reports of clubs wanting to buy Lacazette. And if that is the case, maybe a one-year extension isn't the worst thing in the world. If it gives us an opportunity to sell him down the line. I don't know is the short answer. I don't know what his situation is. I don't know if he's been offered a new contract. Don't know if he...
is for sale?
Is fielding interest. I'm sure he is for sale at the right price. I'm sure he is. But maybe there's not a buyer right now.
But what about this? What if we were to let people know that they could get Lacazette now and pay later? Get your Lacazette now.
Just let the world know we're open to doing that
and pay
by
later.
Doing that with Guendouzi. But yeah, it's an interesting one. I mean, maybe someone will come in. There's a long way to go yet, and there's a lot of dominoes to fall. I'd be quite surprised if they offered him a new deal. But then, if you look at it's a different situation though. I was going to say if you look at what they've tried to do with Eddie Nketiah and Reece Nelson, but that's a bit different. You're protecting a young asset there that's going to retain value better than Lacazette. I feel pretty confident that if it's Mikel Arteta's choice and he's offered, oh, you can have Lacazette around, I think he'll take it. But I hope someone else is making that decision, basically.
Look, I think we should do our best to try and sell him, to be honest. You know, he's got a year left. If we offer him a year extension, he's a year older. He's less valuable next summer. We still have the same problem of trying to sell him. And while I'm not casting any aspersions whatsoever on Lacazette as a professional or anything like that, he would also be quite entitled next summer to say, well, I've got 12 months left on my deal. I like it here. I'll just stay until the end of my deal. I'll see out my contract and then I can leave as a free agent and go wherever. You know what I mean? Which it could be the scenario this summer as well. It could be exactly what he's thinking about this summer. So, and he's perfectly within his rights to do that. But I do feel like this is a player we paid a lot of money for. We can't keep letting players we pay lots of money for leave for free. So I think we've got to do our utmost to sell. But like you say, who's interested and who's out there, that remains to be seen.
Yeah, there may be somebody. I mean, you know, he's a useful player for someone. If but I wonder It'll be fascinating to see if that does come to pass, what kind of fee we're able to extract.
Mm.
Okay. Not a strong point,
no,
to be honest.
It isn't. You know, there's some work to be done to convince people that we're good at that kind of thing. Okay.
Yeah.
Right, we will leave it there. Enjoy the football this week. Semi-finals coming up. Are they on Wednesday or Tuesday?
Tuesday and Wednesday, and then the final on Sunday.
Right. So, big week for all the nations involved and for us neutrals as well. We can get to see some good games. James, thank you very much as always. To you guys for listening, thank you very much. If you want to give us a rating review on iTunes, Apple Podcasts. Does anyone use that anymore? I saw a lot of people saying the Apple Podcast app is terrible now.
I've heard it's bad.
I don't use it because I'm not an Apple-y. I'm an Apple computer guy, but not an Apple phone guy, so I don't use that one. But if you want to give us a review somewhere, anywhere, write it on a toilet wall. 5 stars is the main thing.
Exactly.
All right, we'll catch you on the next one, folks.
Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.